Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We'll have your letters and the thread question at the end of the hour. But now, we're in depth with some clarity in the chaos around Russia. President Trump didn't want it. Vladimir Putin has railed against it, but a bill that will ratchet up sanctions against Russia and North Korea has passed the House and is headed for the Senate. That's in the midst of congressional committee hearings on Russian election hacking, Trump campaign contacts with representatives of the Russian government, and a special counsel probe that the president is clearly worried is widening. Today, a conversation with two Russia experts on why Putin appears to be getting what he wants, how the president's posture on Russia is damaging to American democracy, and why there's more to be revealed through these investigations. Molly McHugh recently wrote in Politico, "No matter what is true or not, we have moved toward the fractured, inward-looking, weakened America that President Putin wants to see." So this is also an opportunity for you to query our guests about Russia. What concerns you, confuses you about U.S. policy towards Russia? What do you want to understand about Putin's strategy toward the United States? So what concerns you, confuses you about, I don't know, the congressional investigations, the foreign policy as regards Vladimir Putin, his strategy towards the United States? Pick your choice there. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Molly McHugh is a foreign policy and strategy consultant with expertise on Russia, and you can read her writings in The Washington Post and Politico and other publications, and she's with us from D.C. And Molly, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Good to talk again.
Julia Yaffe is with us. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers international politics. We'll put a link up to some of the articles that she's written in The Atlantic. I'll tweet that out. Julia, welcome. Good to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Molly, I want to go back to that quote that I read from your June Politico article about Putin. And you used words like weakened and inward looking. And when I read that, I thought, well, is that really Putin's doing, or is this just the latest step in an America that has been fracturing politically for a long time?
It's a fair question. And, you know, I think sometimes there's a lot of confusion on this issue of kind of causality. And certainly I am not saying that the Kremlin is to blame for everything going wrong in American politics today. I think that the end state we have achieved, or at least the current sort of state that we are operating in, which is this sort of constant turmoil and chaos and upheaval and uncertainty and confusion, is exactly what Russian doctrine says they want to achieve in the United States. So granted, they have had some significant contributions to that in various ways in the last few years. It is also, you know, there's a lot of people sort of self-contributing to this mess within the United States. I think President Trump has been a really ready sort of vehicle for what they want to achieve, both because he agrees with them on points of policy and message, but also because he was the chaos candidate, and now he is very much the chaos president. And I think the style that he uses kind of emulates certain aspects that you see from other illiberal leaders in Eastern Europe and in Russia. And that's the part that's really unnerving, I think, for many of us who have watched Russia over the last 15 years.
You know, I'm going to come back to that because I think there's more to say on that. Julia, would Trump's team and administration say, yes, granted, what Molly is saying, Putin seems to be rising in stature in some parts of the world, but, and yeah, we've got these investigations going on Russia, but look at the relationship. It's a lot warmer between, this is Trump, my administration, and a power player in the world. I mean, I may be getting things that Obama never could. Is that a fair response?
No. Look, if you talk to any seasoned diplomats, what they will all tell you is a friendly relationship, a warm relationship is not the end, but the means. So you can that's fine. You can strive for a warmer relationship with an adversary, a more collegial relationship with an adversary, but to what end? To quote the horribly hackneyed phrase from reality shows, not here to make friends. The point of geopolitics is not to make friends. The point is to advance your country's interests, to protect your country's interests. And everything else should serve that. So if you're going to strive for a warmer relationship, that's fine. But what are you getting from it? Like, it's not enough to just have a warmer relationship. And so far, the U.S. hasn't gotten anything out of an offense. And I wouldn't even say the relationship is warmer. I think it's still extremely frayed. So far, the U.S. hasn't gotten anything out of it. And Russia has taken a posture from the very beginning of the Trump administration saying, you know, go ahead and, for example, at the very beginning when they still were confident that the Trump administration would unilaterally lift sanctions, Russia sanctions, they said, fine, lift sanctions, but you did that, so you lift them on your own. We're not going to give you anything for it. So, again, the question is, it's one thing to lift sanctions. The other thing is, what are you getting for it? The sanctions weren't put in just to be mean. The point of the sanctions was to achieve a certain diplomatic, geopolitical goal. And short of getting that, you have to think about what is the point?
Yeah, call here from John in Minneapolis for you, Molly. Hi, John.
Yeah, just to make a general statement about Russia, I think that just historically and culturally and their experiences of the last 25 years, they are so different from us. They're just unscrutable. You just really can't understand them unless, you know, you really, I would say, spend a lot of time studying it. And there's just, you know, it's very corrupt. The Tsarist system was corrupt. The Soviet Union was oppressive and totalitarian. And now you have this oligarchical system that, who knows what to make of Putin. He is supposedly very religious. He's given a lot of money to the Orthodox Church and to Mount Athos. He's a major contributor to that. And yet, you know, he was KGB, and I'm sure he's involved in some really unsavory kinds of things.
Well, John, let me take the original premise of your comment, which, Molly, is that it's a very different culture, and it would be difficult under any circumstances for the United States to have a good alliance. I don't think that precludes a working and productive relationship, does it?
No, not necessarily. I think, part of the challenge is the caller was exactly right. There are a lot of historical and cultural and sort of other differences between us. But that's true of the United States and many countries with whom we have perfectly productive, open, cooperative relationships. The issue right now is that since the end of the Cold War, there were sort of the 90s, which is kind of its own thing, but since Putin took over the Kremlin, there has been a very single-minded pursuit from the Kremlin. And again, these are not things that are questioned. The sort of amazing thing about our Russian opponents is they write all of this down, and we just choose not to read it and listen to it. But they very clearly state the United States of America remains their primary adversary in the world, and that they are using a new type of sort of global guerrilla warfare, so any means can be used to attack your opponent, to weaken us and our interests in order to promote their own. Until we embrace that as sort of a core part of our own strategy and response, we're just way behind on understanding what's happening. So yes, there are a lot of differences, and yes, you can sort of look back to history and everything else, but that's kind of what Putin wants us to do. The most important thing is to look at what's happening now. Look at Russian actions now, and what does that say? And what you have is just about anywhere they can, the Russians have lined up on the opposite side of American interests. Even if you just look at hot wars and conflicts, they are on the other side of us in Afghanistan, arming the Taliban, which is shooting at and killing Americans. They are on the other side of us in North Korea, providing technology and support to the regime. They are on the other side of us in Syria and Iraq, working against our interests, opposing our forces, chasing our planes off of ISIS targets. They are on the other side of us in Libya, sort of working to secure their own interests against kind of the broader international mandate of providing security. Anywhere they can, they've lined up on the other side. And I think we need to accept that. We need to look at that in terms of our own culture, strategically and diplomatically. And we need to make better choices about what that means, and exactly what Julia was saying, which is we need to be very clear about what we're getting out of any of these interactions. It's not just about us wanting a better relationship with Russia. They need to want a better relationship with us, and they've shown that they don't.
Julia, I was reading something that you wrote about Michael Flynn, who, for listeners who don't remember this, ended up leaving the administration really early on. But you've written that when that happened, Russia lost their quote-unquote main ally, which made me curious about how that might have played out. Let's say Flynn had survived as a national security advisor. I mean, how would he be wielding his influence in a way that Russia wanted?
Well, I know that even right after Flynn's departure, the people he kind of left at the National Security Council were still exploring ways that we could lift sanctions unilaterally. And that ran into some pretty stiff resistance, and then the administration dropped it because the main motor of that policy had left. I think that we would be seeing a lot more of a push to, for example, counter the sanctions bill that has passed the House and the Senate with such incredible margins, given that, you know, there's such partisanship, they can't seem to get anything else done. And probably we might have seen more moves to lift the sanctions. I just want to address something the caller said.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with Molly, but I also wanted to address the caller specifically. This is part of the Russian game. And the Russians love to believe this about themselves, and they love to quote this old Russian early 19th century poet saying that you can't understand Russia with your mind, that it's just so mysterious and so strange and contains so many multitudes that it's just beyond comprehension. It's something akin to some kind of holy emanation that cannot be encompassed with the human mind. And that's just, I'm sorry, that's just BS. It's a country like any other. It's a country with its own history that it has dealt with and not dealt with. It has, you know, it's a country like any other, and like any other country, it can be understood if you pay attention and you open your ears and your eyes and your mind. I totally agree with Molly. They say what they want. They're not really that mysterious. And what they want is, like Molly said, the U.S. is their primary adversary, and they want to be taken seriously, but not because of anything that they do necessarily, not because they have some kind of constructive, positive program of things they want to accomplish in the world, but because they want to throw sand in the gears of how the West operates.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, I'm still under the weather a little bit, so I have a raspy voice. But it's to knock the U.S. down a few notches. It's to, you know, introduce tension and friction into how we maneuver in the world. Putin said 10 years ago at the Munich Security Conference in 2007, he was addressing what he saw happening in the world dominated by a very expansive America under George W. Bush that he very much disagreed with. And he said, we can't have a unipolar world. You know, in the Cold War, during the Cold War, we had a bipolar world. We had the U.S. and the Soviet Union constantly fighting with each other, butting heads, you know, kind of. And he was saying that tension, that friction was a good thing in the world. But when you have one country running roughshod all over the world, and Putin's view is a bad thing, and it's antithetical to democracy. And in that 10 years, he has been single-mindedly pursuing that, throwing sand in the gears, getting in the way, and just saying, you can't just make these decisions on your own. We might not have a constructive alternative to your decision or to your position. We just want to make it more difficult for you to do that just because we think that it's not fair that you have all this power. Again, it's not a terribly sophisticated strategy or worldview, but it is what it is. And he has said it quite clearly. And if we listen, we can get a pretty good idea of what Russia wants to do.
You know what I was thinking as I listened to that, Molly, you know, there might be some who would agree with the first part of Putin's beliefs about we shouldn't have a unipolar world and it's not good that so much power accrues, except for the fact that they represent such a malevolent force, right? I mean, when you put Putin into that equation, then it changes the dynamic of his argument. But the argument itself, at least the beginning of that argument, is something that there's probably plenty of world leaders that believe.
And plenty of regular humans, too. I think this is where the Kremlin has been particularly successful in how they have built their propaganda structure and their narratives and how they have built very tactical alliances. You know, they sort of find people who agree with them on one point. Well, don't you agree the Americans shouldn't have so much power? Well, don't you agree that, you know, there's too much gay rights in the world? Well, don't you agree that you know, there should be more traditionalism? Don't you agree XYZ? And they sort of build relationships with people on whatever that core bit was. And then they sort of expand outward, and they're very successful at capturing different representation groups into their narratives with whatever that initial entry point was, by funding groups and sort of helping them in different ways. And they sort of build this very Frankenstein alliance of interests that are aiding the Kremlin agenda, because, again, what they're trying to achieve is not necessarily one particular goal. It is this state of more fluid chaos in which they believe they can more ably operate. And that's why, you know, some of the stories coming out about the Trump-Russia stuff and the Clinton-Ukraine stuff and the Clinton-Russia stuff all seem so confusing, but that is how a Russian operation looks. They operate on every side of a fight they can get in on, because that's how they believe they can most ably pull the strings. And it's really hard for Americans to think this way and sort of see this, but that is what they do. I mean, just one quick example of that, you know, in Ukraine during the Euromaidan and sort of after, there were obviously the pro-Russian forces in the country that the Russians were backing, but they also were backing various Ukrainian ultranationalist causes, not all of them, but some, to sort of help stir up this conflict, but to drive the sort of pretext for why Russia needed to intervene. And it's really hard for us to see those things and think that way, but that is how they operate. They try to be on every side of a thing to drive the outcome. And that is sometimes why it's very hard to understand what the goal is beyond creating a mess that they believe they can achieve a favorable outcome from.
Molly McHugh and Julia Yaffe with us this morning to give us some insight, the benefit of their reporting and investigation and experience on Russia, and acknowledging here this morning that there are a lot of different pieces to how we're thinking about Russia. I mean, we've got these congressional investigations. We haven't even talked about that yet. But the sanctions bill that has gone through the House and is likely to pass the Senate, if it hasn't already. Julia, it hasn't passed the Senate yet, has it?
It has. It went from the Senate
to
the House.
Okay, got it.
The House made some changes, and now it's now we're waiting for the president to decide if he's going to veto it or sign it. Scaramucci, his new communications director, made some noise about maybe the president will veto it and renegotiate. But I mean, to get such a bipartisan consensus these days is unheard of. And I want to go back to something Molly said just now. Mm-hmm. I think it's spot on, and I think that the Russians operate a little bit like, you know, Johnny Cochran in the O.J. Simpson trial. Mm-hmm. They're the defense attorney. Their job is not to find another suspect and present a coherent case. Their job is not to systematically dismantle the case that you're making. Their job is just to muddy the water a little bit to get you away from beyond a reasonable doubt in anything. So they will throw things in the water to just so that you don't know what's true anymore. And if there's even a thing such as truth or objectivity, it's kind of postmodernism on steroids. But the whole idea is to just, it's confusing just enough so that you kind of withdraw, so that you don't, so you say, you know, how can we even possibly understand this? And who can really know what's actually going on? When in fact you can, if you filter out the noise, but they just make it a bit more of an energy intensive process to discourage people from doing that.
Anthony on Twitter says, Molly and Julia are so spot on regarding Russia and Putin. Then he asked who you both are with. So Julia is with The Atlantic, and Molly McHugh is a foreign policy and strategy consultant and writes a lot about Russia as well. And then Anthony adds on Twitter, particularly Trump isn't necessarily doing the bidding of Putin, but rather is chaos destabilizing agent of a major adversary. Molly, is that assessment correct in your view?
Yeah. You know, I think it's hard to know what is the actual, you know, is there coordination of any of this or if it matters. And I think this is what you've seen in a number of other countries. If you look at Turkey, if you look at Hungary, if you look at Poland, if you look at other places that we sort of now put in the shifting toward illiberal democracy. So a more controlled, less individual rights based, less rules based system of quote unquote democracy, you know, and like no one would say that Poland is pro-Russia, but it's sort of de facto aligning itself into that column by taking some of these steps. And I think that that is where Trump has really put himself at this point in the Venn diagram with sort of these other not necessarily great actors. And I think the concern is that this is where he feels most comfortable. And it's not just now. It's not just the most recent series of interactions, of the meeting with Putin, the second meeting with Putin, the other things that are going on. You know, right after the election, the first set of phone calls that Trump did was with what we would count as liberal leaders. These are the people that he feels he caucuses with. If you listen to some of his ideologues in the White House.
I want to make sure people understand that word that you're using. You're saying illiberal.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Because it sounds like you're saying liberal. You're saying I-L-L-I-E-B-E-R. Okay, good. So we're on that. Go ahead.
So the opposite of liberal democratic order is this other group that sort of rejects the idea of a fair application of rule of law and sort of manipulates it in different ways. That's the most simple way to describe it. It's actually more complicated than that. But I mean, you see him sort of caucusing with these people. You see people like Steve Bannon, the president's advisor, who has very clearly articulated that he believes Trump can be the head of this new global political movement that is sort of rejecting the post-World War II order and establishing something new. And we all sort of dismiss it and laugh at it at times because it seems so ridiculous, but you see sort of clear steps being taken in that direction. And I think, you know, sort of a benchmark on that was this speech that President Trump gave in Poland, which, you know, I think a lot of speechwriters sort of, the presidential speechwriters sort of went on TV and said, oh, this was a great speech.
Yeah, they
did. It was his most presidential speech. And, you know, that's fine. But there was a lot of, it was sort of a Steve Bannon and Steve Miller speech that was sort of, you know, had a few points shoved in by McMaster and others. But it said the things that people were listening to. He kind of supported Ukraine. He kind of supported NATO. But he gave an entire speech in Poland without mentioning democracy once, because he's not talking about democratic values. He's not talking about the shared values that have emerged in the post-World War II structure and order with the EU and NATO. He was very much hearkening back to things that Putin talks about a lot. Civilizational values, this idea of a thousand-year history that sort of white Christianity is tied into. And if you look at the way that the Poles reacted to that speech, that the Hungarians reacted to that speech, that others sort of listened to the messages that he was dropping, it was a very clear signal to the Kremlin that this is where they are moving toward, this is what they believe in, and that set the stage for a very positive meeting with President Putin at the G20.
Here's a little excerpt of President Trump recently in Poland speaking to some of these issues that Molly just described.
Americans know that a strong alliance of free, sovereign, and independent nations is the best defense for our freedoms and for our interests. That is why my administration has demanded that all members of NATO finally meet their full and fair financial obligation.
That is President Trump recently in Poland. We're talking this morning about the chaos and some of the confusion around keeping up with these stories on Russia, the congressional investigations, President Trump's posture towards Russia, what Putin wants, and taking your calls and questions for our guests who are experts on this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can get to me on Twitter at Carrie NPR. To Brandon listening in Kansas City. Hi, Brandon.
Hi. My question is just about what Julia said about Russia wanting to sort of throw sand in the cogs of how we work and take us down a few pegs. Really, if Trump also wants us to become sort of a liberal democracy, what does that look like in 4 years? What does it look like in 8 years if he is not stopped on that end?
Julia?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I quite understood the question.
Did you say, Brandon, that that Trump may have a similar goal as Putin to undermine our democracy, and what would that potentially look like?
Well, as far as wanting an illiberal democracy, like what Russia has,
I think that's an excellent question. I'm sorry I didn't understand it at first, but I don't think so. I think that they're speaking two different languages that just happen to overlap just enough. I think Trump doesn't understand the game he's playing. I think he's honestly completely out of his depth, and Putin's going to eat him like a sandwich. And I think that Trump just admires Putin because he's a strong man, because he does a lot of he does and gets away with a lot of the things that Trump, I think, would like to get away with. You know, going after the press, the fake news, going after his opponents as harshly as he does. I think Trump just doesn't understand certain democratic norms and laws and practices in his bones the way that Putin doesn't and doesn't respect them. But I don't think that Trump understands what he's doing. I think he thinks he's making the U.S. better and stronger. Unfortunately, he isn't, and Putin understands that very well. He understands that all this infighting, all this chaos, all this political chaos internally in the U.S. is redounding to Putin's benefit. And it's because in part, I have to – so there's all this talk about Trump and Putin dismantling the post-World War II order. That's not quite right. Russia was fine with the post-World War II order. It was part of negotiating that order, and it had quite a lot of power and leverage. What it's not fine with is the post-Cold War order, the post-1991 order, when the Soviet Union lost and the Western liberal democracies won, and the consensus was that liberal democracy is just, it's better, it's more moral, it's more efficient, it's the best way to rule populations as opposed to communism, authoritarianism, etc. And now Russia's saying, hold up, it's been 25 years and it looks like things haven't worked out that well for you. And all these people inside Russia, inside of the former Soviet republics, in Eastern Europe that used to be under Soviet sway, that were trying to be like the West, that were striving and reaching for Western norms and Western lifestyles. Do you really want to live like these people? Look at this. It's chaos. It's inefficient. It's just as corrupt. It's no better. Why don't you fight for your team, for the, you know, for the white Christian Slavs?
Hmm. You know, Molly, I want to, when I take in this news and read the analysis, I try to resist turning Putin into some master villain. You know what I mean, because that's a slippery slope too, right? But when I hear Julia say things like Trump's out of his depth, which is certainly what it looks like, you just can't help but think Putin is, well, like you've written, getting what he wants and using President Trump in a way that the president truly isn't aware of.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I think that, you know, that clip you played before from President Trump's speech in Warsaw, you know, he says free, sovereign, independent nations.
Right.
What he does not say is values, democracy, alliances. And that is the difference that is so critical. I mean, to hear the American president attacking NATO in front of NATO allies, which is something that the Russians have wanted for a really long time, is sort of this absolutely unbelievable thing to see. You know, are there valid points in terms of NATO needing to up its defense commitments and sort of rethink what the alliance is? Of course. But attacking NATO and calling it weak in this way has been such a boon to Putin and the Russian propaganda machine that it's just unbelievable. And I think that, you know, everything you just said is right. There is this sort of You know, Putin the boogeyman, you know, the Kremlin has this all-powerful star chamber that's controlling the universe dynamic that's emerged from some of these discussions, or at least that is the accusation that some levy against us, that this is what we're saying. But it's obviously not true. I think the key thing that's missing, and it's the same if you look even just at the disinformation piece of this, you know, Russian disinformation has purpose. Even though in the West we have started to expose the disinformation and identify the information, there is no purpose behind our response to it, and nothing driving a counter-narrative that is compelling or you know, aggressive in any way, shape, or form. It's the same with our strategies on Russia writ large. And I think this is really where you get into this dynamic with Trump, where regardless what he thinks he is getting out of this footsie with Russia, which every other administration has tried and failed to use in a useful way, the chaos that it is causing within his team. You have a White House that is at war with itself, and this is a dynamic that the president seems to fuel.
But that could be happening. That would probably be happening whether, you know, Putin was a factor or not. Right.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. But yeah. You have this, you know, this dynamic of internal war. There's no unity of purpose or mission on countering the investigations against them on any sort of policy or narrative. You have a president who's constantly throwing his own team members under the bus, sort of creating this Game of Thrones dynamic, which propels the leaks and sort of self-protection that he rails against the most. And then you throw Russians into the mix with this. And their interest is only in fueling this chaos. And it's absolutely becoming like this catastrophic, never-ending echo chamber of ridiculousness. And the only way out of it is for us to have a president that has a clear policy position on Russia that aligns with the threat assessment of the entire intelligence community of the United States and the entire opinion of the military leadership of the United States. Period. End of story. And right now you have a president whose opinions run counter to that. And a White House who is willing to sort of disrupt the ability of the rest of the government to do this in soft ways. And that is a really difficult dynamic to manage, and not something you haven't seen other places. There's a lot of actually Eastern European countries where you have sort of a pro-Russian president countered by a non-pro-Russian parliament or vice versa. But this is something we're not used to dealing with. We're used to having the president lead on key initiatives, and Trump just refuses to admit that Russia is an adversary of the United States and that they are working against our interests now and continually.
Questions coming in here about protests. We'll get to that. And about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's I think Bill Clinton's speech in Moscow. I know that's been making the rounds on the Internet. So we'll talk about that. We'll take a couple of questions again about what the president does or does not owe Vladimir Putin, his own, personal financial affairs. We'll try to get to that as well. We'll get to a look at the latest news and then back to your calls and questions on Russia. To Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Senate Republicans are lowering their expectations on repealing and replacing Obamacare. Today, they will try to pass a narrowly focused bill. It's being called a skinny repeal, and it could delete individual and employer mandates. The Senate wants to pass some kind of health care bill that would start talks with the House, which passed its own more comprehensive repeal and replace bill in early May. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is flying to El Salvador on a mission to find ways to stamp out the brutal street gang MS-13. He opened his trip today after a week of public scorn from President Trump. Sessions is showing no outward signs he is planning to quit. Instead, he is forging ahead with a tough-on-crime agenda. Senior U.S. officials say the Trump administration plans to push for additional inspections of Iranian military sites. The officials say Trump is looking to test and pressure the Iranian government and potentially expose flaws in the nuclear agreement. The officials spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity. Trump has been a longtime critic of the Obama-era deal between Tehran and world powers. As a candidate, he repeatedly vowed to pull out of the deal. Thousands of Muslims have flocked to a contested Jerusalem holy site for the first organized prayers in almost 2 weeks. This after Israel removed controversial security measures placed at the entrance of the shrine. They went up following an attack in which three gunmen killed two Israeli police officers. And a Columbus, Ohio fire official says an 18-year-old was killed after an aggressive thrill ride fell apart at the Ohio State Fair last night. Seven other people were injured on the fireball ride. They range in age from 13 to 41. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:41.
Coming up on NPR News, a conversation with five Republican governors about healthcare, opioids, cybersecurity, and other issues. Wisconsin's Scott Walker and North Dakota's Doug Burgum are among the five you'll hear at noon. Please subscribe to the podcast for this show. All the interviews from the 11 o'clock hour are available, including yesterday's conversation about student loan forgiveness programs. You can find that on the podcast wherever you find your podcast. Search for NPR News with Tom Weber.
I bring you news of tickets for Talking Volumes that are flying out of here. If you want to be in the audience when Sherman Alexie comes to Talking Volumes, yes, indeed, he'll be here on September 14th. You better get your tickets now. Amy Tan, Dan Brown, Ron Cherno, Jacqueline Woodson, we are selling like hotcakes. And if you want to be in the audience, I want you to be there, too. Go to the Fitzgerald Theater website for your tickets. I will see you there.
Programming supported by the Shakopee Mattawakutan Sioux community, home of one of the Midwest's largest green roofs, a biomass heat and power plant, an organics recycling facility, and other earth-friendly programs to protect our lands and waters for the next seven generations.
Back to our conversation now. Julia Yaffe with us from The Atlantic. Molly McHugh, a strategies, foreign policy and strategy consultant. And right to the phones here to Pete. Pete, I know it's been a while. Thanks so much for waiting. Tell me what you're curious about.
No problem. I was just wondering about the guest response to the skepticism regarding the Trump-Russia stories from folks like The Intercept and Masha Gessen. You know, they've been you know, definitely left wing, and they've definitely been a force that's been just trying to tear apart the Russia story. I'm just wondering about their responses to it.
Julia, I check out The Intercept on the recommendation of a friend who said I should put it on my dashboard. What do you make of some of the media's skepticism about it?
I think it's very healthy, and I've had a lot of skepticism myself about this too, in part because some of the stories that we're seeing about the Russia story don't sound like they're about Russia. They don't sound like the Russia that we've all reported on and know so well. It's not this strategic, efficient juggernaut. It's, you know, it's wildly inefficient, internally competitive. One hand doesn't know what the other is doing. A lot of corruption and inefficiency. And I think a lot of times we're getting ahead of the facts and we want to get right to the end of, you know, can we impeach him? Is this it? Is this a smoking gun? I think that, you know, we live in this very high-paced media environment, whereas this story is going to be with us for a couple of years, and it's going to be—it's going to have to take slow, methodical reporting, and a lot of it is a domestic story. And I think a lot of the skepticism comes from the fact that a lot of the reporters reporting on the Russia story are American reporters who have never dealt with Russia, who have never been to Russia, who have never studied Russia, and their image of Russia is this, you know, Hunt for Red October, James Bond type of country, and, you know, nothing can be further from the truth, and that colors their reporting. And there's also a lot of skepticism, for example, from reporters who are in Russia. A lot of my friends and colleagues who are reporting this story out of Moscow, who have been there for years, are like, which country are you guys reporting on? Because it doesn't sound like Russia at all.
Wow.
And I think the story is somewhere in the middle. I think those guys can be a little too dismissive because they've been in Russia for so long and they see that nothing works and everything's inefficient and corrupt. And, you know, and they think, how come nothing works except for this operation? And so they can be a little too dismissive, whereas on the other side, we have a lot of American reporters who think Russia is capable of everything and that for breakfast every morning, Vladimir Putin feasts on babies. So I think there's something, I think we have to stick to the facts and to reporting and try to really understand what we're seeing instead of letting our imaginations run wild in either direction.
This is good. Okay. So again, beware of the master villain portrait be realistic. Read from a lot of different sources. That's super valuable, no matter what, right? No matter what story.
Yes, absolutely.
Molly, David on Twitter says, and I want to address this because I know this has been circulating, please comment on the quid pro quo between Bill Clinton's, I don't know, is he saying $5 million speech in Moscow and Secretary of State Clinton's position on removing sanctions. I don't think Secretary of State Clinton held a position on removing. If she did, if she was opposed to removing sanctions from Russia, wasn't she?
I think if it's the you know, various stories circulating the internet that I think he's referring to, I think he's probably referring to the story about the approval of the sale of some American uranium assets to a Russian company when Clinton was Secretary of State,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that her husband has given paid speeches in the past to Russian banks, et cetera. I think it was like a $500,000 speech, which again, I'm not dismissing. I would like to give a $500,000 speech, but. I mean, look, the problem for a lot of us in this is the 8 years of the Obama administration were not a great period on U.S.-Russia policy either. I believe the reset was a tremendous strategic failure.
Mm-hmm.
It opened a ton of space into which Vladimir Putin walked. He is not really that much of a risk taker, but if there is an opportunity in front of him, he takes it, and he has. And by the end of the Obama administration, he very much understood the psychology of the president, and he knew that there would not be a quick response to anything, and there would be long deliberations and sort of deliberateness. And Putin exploited that and continued to push forward up until the minute that Obama left office, knowing that he could take and hold that space if the next American president didn't challenge him. So I think there are all these narratives out there about, you know, the obsession with the Clintons still. You know, Clinton did this, Clinton did that, Clinton had dumb stuff on Russia. And don't get me wrong, I was working on Georgia when people who were funneling information to the Secretary of State, then Clinton, were representing the Gazprom oligarch on the other side without registering. So there are a lot of sort of people floating in the Clintonosphere that have ties to Russia and Russian interests that are troubling. But this is the same in just about every aspect of Washington. And it's one of the things that many of us have been trying to raise concern on for a long time. You know, the Kremlin's new ideology of export is kleptocracy, which means their means of recruitment of allies is money. And the money has been something that no one has been willing to identify, speak clearly on, and counter for a long time. You know, Russia is not stealing and exporting its wealth just to buy super yachts and condos and penthouses in New York and Miami. There is purpose behind a lot of this money. It is to buy access and influence in a number of countries, partially for financial and economic interest, partially for means of power, partially for means of influence and access and other things. But there is purpose behind a lot of this money, and that's why you see it. And in any place where Russia has an interest, you know, they're cultivating financial elite, they're cultivating cultural elite, they're cultivating ties with political elite, anywhere they can get into, because you never know who's going to be useful. And so there, on the Clinton side, certainly there are people connected to Russia taking money from Russian interests. On the Trump side, certainly there are many people connected to Russia and taking money from Russian interests. You know, Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, took money from Kremlin interests. There's Russians kind of everywhere, and not all of those are necessarily agents of influence of the Kremlin, but... you know, to the point that Julia was making about it's not this extremely organized, streamlined juggernaut, that is true. I think that the system that has been cultivated is one of standing orders. So it's I think my editor at Politico, Blake Hounsell, was reminding me of this the other day. It's what was, in the Nazi context, was referred to as working toward the Führer. Mm-hmm. People understood if there's certain things you can do that will yield you great reward. And so this environment that's been cultivated in sort of what we think of as the intelligence influence space is one of tremendous entrepreneurism. It's huge risk-taking culture. So a lot of individuals, you know, some guy who was a former GRU guy or some guy who's a Russian-connected or a, you know, Kremlin-connected lawyer, they know, I'm going to try to do this. I'm going to try to build a relationship with someone. I'm going to try to see what I can figure out. If they fail, nobody cares. Nobody's keeping track of it. But if they succeed, the potential for reward is tremendous. And they know that. And so this is kind of this, it's this weird informal entrepreneurial culture of access and influence that has been built. And we are not good at identifying what that is, how that works, that it has had purpose, and that it has been tremendously effective in penetrating our societies in the West, especially in the United States and in Europe.
Molly, I really appreciate the insight and the time for us. Thanks so much for doing this.
Happy to do it.
And Julia, I didn't know you were under the weather, so I'm really grateful that we've been able to benefit from your reporting. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Julia Yaffe from The Atlantic and Molly McHugh Fianna, Strategies Foreign Policy and a Strategy Consultant. That, by the way, is a very popular pop song we hear in Russia where the singer says, "I want a man like Putin." So do with that what you will.